Welcome to Worlds Apart. The cities once considered to be the cradle of civilization have come full circle to sap life out of it, but it doesn't have to be this way. This is an argument put forth by my guest today. And he doesn't just preach it. He moved from Moscow to Siberia to make his own life more fulfilling and advance a new brand of urbanism, the one that informs the designs of cities with the needs of a human soul. How is it possible? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Russian urban sociologist Petr Ivanov. Petr, спасибо большое.
Petr, thank you for your time.
Happy to be here.
From what I've learned about you, it seems to me that in the age-old debate between Hegel and Marx as to what ultimately takes priority, consciousness or existence, you seem to be more in line with Marx. In other words, you believe that one's environment determines their perception of the world. Did I get that right?
Well, I'd say it always comes down to making your claim on something. Henri Lefebvre, a prominent post-Marxist philosopher, said that all of us have a right to the city, a right to shape our environment, and therefore decide how the environment will affect us in return. Much of the urban dynamics unfold exactly like that, with groups of people claiming their right to determine what their city should look like. And I think that's crucial. It teaches us the city is not something fixed or static. The city is always an arena where multiple different views clash with each other. In that sense, it seems to me that the kind of city we'd call a good city is one that enables as much of the population as possible to be involved in this process.
Going back to Marx and Hegel, personally, I think both have a point. It just plays out differently at different stages of life. First, the environment influences your mind, then your mind affects the environment. But I do agree with you that a nurturing environment makes life more enjoyable, and enjoyment is a basic, existential kind of emotion. My question is, what tools or techniques could we use to maximize our enjoyment of life, our happiness?
Well, it's not really rocket science. There are some very basic factors that affect a person's mental state. For example, living in an environment with a lot of finer details that grab your attention. The drab and monotone surroundings, which you can often find on the edges of our cities in the suburbs, have a negative impact on your mental health. By contrast, if you look at some of the old buildings of, say, the 19th or early 20th centuries, they are bursting with details, and your brain actually picks up on them, making you feel better.
How does that work? Is it about authenticity, or variability, or perhaps novelty and randomness?
It has to do with being sort of captivating.
What do you mean by that?
If you look at nature, say, when you go to a park, you see trees. Trees are fractal in nature. They endlessly repeat nearly identical patterns, while also producing an insane amount of variety. In fact, the human eye is very much used to dealing with fractal forms, and the closer the environment we observe is to a fractal, the better.
So essentially, the more things we create that resemble nature, its diversity, the easier it gets for us to deal with it.
Correct.
That's fascinating. By the way, I learned from one of your lectures a fact that genuinely surprised me. You said that in the cities where people typically live in multi-story buildings, people's perception of the world changes once they move above a certain floor.
The eighth floor.
Yes, the eighth. But how does it change?
It's because the view from the window turns into a kind of painting, just a picture. There have been various studies looking at people who live on the 7th, 8th, 9th floors, etc. It turns out there's a line you cross at some point. in the way you perceive the view out of your window. It's no longer personal, but rather detached, abstracted. When we live on the sixth floor, we feel like we're actually involved in everything that happens in the neighborhood, whether we want to or not. There's a sense of engagement, of belonging. But as soon as we go up, say to the 12th floor, the view from the window becomes more like a picture, an image on a TV screen, some kind of distant spectacle we have no role in.
You see the sky.
Other than as a spectator. Obviously, things are still happening out there, but we no longer define ourselves through them. We're no more than passive spectators.
Fascinating. I also recall you making the point that the rectangular shapes prevalent in Russian urban spaces have a depressing effect on the human psyche. Could you explain why?
Consider a tree and compare it to a square. A tree is as far removed from a square as it gets. You can't imagine a rectangular tree, unless, of course, you've trimmed it into that shape on purpose.
What about rectangular mountains? That's an exception, of course, but it happens.
A mountain would still have some type of a complex fractal shape. Again, like I said, natural-looking objects are pleasant to look at, whereas objects that are unnatural to the greatest extent, like ones that have a lot of right angles, make us oppressed. Because it's an environment that is unfamiliar to us. An environment which, biologically, is alien to us. From an evolutionary standpoint, the history of right angles is just a flash, mere thousands of years.
But from a financial point of view, surely a building like that is more cost-effective, easier to construct, or am I wrong?
No, you're exactly right. Obviously, building something natural-looking is a costly affair. That's why we optimize our construction practice in such a way as to get the most out of each square meter.
Have you noticed any changes in the overall trends? Because on the one hand, for a country where multiple generations of a family have had to share the same room, it's probably better to live in a larger building, no matter how rectangular, as long as they can all have separate spaces. But as people's basic needs are met, perhaps some other necessities come into play. Is there a particular trend in Russia or elsewhere to sort of embellish your living space? Not necessarily to make it resemble nature. That would be way too expensive. Take, for example, the traditional Russian plaid bands in our towns and villages. The houses look somewhat similar, but each has its own identity.
There's a kind of a tax on distinctness. Your average consumer can only afford to live in a relatively uncomfortable environment. It's only the wealthy who can afford better environments. That's a huge problem. Natural-looking things are very expensive. So the people who can afford them generally live in a more pleasant environment. But this is in no way a mass phenomenon. And unfortunately, so far, the mass consumer can only afford surroundings that are detrimental to them.
I believe what sets modern cities and even countries apart is their ability to accommodate the needs, sometimes even conflicting needs, of multiple, very distinct social groups. Going back to your point about the level of comfort, I've lived in many cities throughout my life, but I chose to move to Moscow because I believe there is a very good balance here between the comforts of modern civilization and the availability of nature, parks, rivers, etc. But I do know that you have a very different outlook, and that's why you left the capital. Was it really about Moscow as a city, or perhaps it's about personal preferences?
To me, as a professional, what comes first is how Moscow manages its urban dynamics. I left the city because I disagreed with the way it was handled. The whole process was way too vertical for me, very top-down and prescriptive. I knew I had no way to influence my environment there. In Krasnoyarsk, where I live today, I feel that I have much more ownership of the city, that nothing can be imposed on me by force.
What do you mean by that? Say you want to change something in your neighborhood. Do you mean it'll be much easier to do that in Krasnoyarsk compared to Moscow?
Sort of. At the very least, I will never find myself in a situation where I'm threatened with physical violence, which is not uncommon in Moscow.
As far as I know, in Moscow, and again, we could disagree on this, the authorities here, including at a local level, like in my own district, are doing a great deal to involve the public in urban development. Sure, it may have something to do with politics. For example, if a person has a say in how a park in their neighborhood is renovated, they will more likely vote for the head of the local administration, etc. Still, the process is very slow because, on the one hand, people often prefer this paternalistic attitude where someone else does everything for you. But on the other hand, many of them won't even clean up after their dogs in the park. How can we strike a balance here? How do we build horizontal communication between the person trying to shape their environment and the city authorities that, in a sense, are charged with making sure that everyone finds their environment comfortable?
I believe Moscow was just too late to realize this. They should have started earlier. In 2012, my colleagues and I from the Graduate School of Urbanism ran a participatory urban design project where we showed that participatory design has a kind of magic effect to it. People become involved, they get to open up about what they want, and they're happy with the result. But the Moscow authorities just patted us on the back and went back to ignoring us, preferring the old top-down approach. Meanwhile, surprisingly enough, regional authorities across Russia started to lean a lot towards participatory urban planning. And now it's seen as healthy to consult with local communities about all sorts of landscaping and development projects. In Moscow, however, this approach only started to gain traction a year and a half ago.
Well, I say better late than never. Does that only happen on paper as a formal procedure? Or do people actually get a chance to shape their own environment? I mean, agreeing on things, reaching a consensus with their neighbors.
It depends on the contractors. There are teams who actually seek to engage the residents, give them a voice, so they can have a real impact on the final project. But then there are slackers who only follow the formal procedure. They hold a workshop with the people only to ignore their wishes and design something completely different. Unfortunately, urban development is very much dependent on the contractor. There's no professional standard, no established procedure when it comes to participatory planning. So there are good contractors and there are bad ones.
Do you think the authorities understand that it's in their own political interest, not only for the people to see their efforts when it comes to making the city better, but also for them to feel a sense of belonging, of engagement?
It also depends on the authorities. Because there is no formalized procedure, the authorities can be involved to different extents. When we worked with Alzamay in the Irkutsk region, and we've done two urban planning projects there, the authorities, the mayor, were very much involved. And we saw that he understood how meaningful it all was. But there are also cases when the administration orders the services because it looks good on paper, but later on it all comes to nothing. So that is the level we have to operate at right now. But what are you going to do?
To live with it, to develop it. Speaking of what we're going to do, we are going to take a short break right now.
We will be back after a short break. Stay tuned.
Нашей ті люди, які ще да проголосили себе, као, вони, які чувають і звонять.
Rat u Bosni i Hercegovini u tom smislu je bio prekretnica u razvoju globalnog džihada. Kraju su cijelu Bosnu i Hercegovinu definisali kao to jedno mjesto na kome će biti muđahedini i tako su nastale vehabijske komune i tako su nastali paralelni džemati.
Međutim, ono što nas ovdje zabrinjava jeste ta potpuna radikalizacija bošnjačke omladine koji i danas zagovaraju dakle, politike u kojima je dozvoljeno ubijanje Srba.
Pretvara u stvari u vojnu bazu radikalnog islama koja direktno prijeti i regionu, prijeti dakle prvo svojim komšijama, Srbima i Hrvatima, zatim prijeti i cijelom evropskom kontinentu.
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Russian urban sociologist Peter Ivanov.
Peter, you are the creator and editor of the Urbanism is Life Purpose channel. I agree that urbanism is about purpose and meaning, life purpose for the most part. But life is viewed differently by different people. Russian and Soviet culture promoted the image of strong, resilient people. In a way, it makes sense, considering our geography, history, and our political context. People had to survive, but now we're talking about living, not just surviving. Living full, conscious, meaningful lives in harmony. How far do you think Russians are from the point where they will have enough energy and resources to focus on the extras that we're talking about right now?
Our research shows that Russians are not satisfied with their way of life. They want to live different lives. The average Russian wants to live away from big cities, be surrounded by nature and nice neighbors in a low-rise suburban house. But in reality, the average Russian lives in an urban setting, in a high-rise building, 25 floors or even more, and doesn't know their neighbors. This is actually a big problem. The Russian dream of living comfortably is not coming true.
Is this problem caused by the cities, or is it an issue of that average Russian? You are talking about deep existential issues. When I hear you speak, I sometimes feel like you are trying to blame city authorities. Where should we start? From the outside or from the inside? We are talking about underlying psychological issues, when people are supposed to work on understanding themselves better, who they are and what they need to do to make their lives the way they want them to be.
It's not just some personal motivation we're dealing with here. When presented with a choice between suburban low-rise housing and an apartment in a high-rise building, the person won't choose the apartment and then continue to dream about suburban life.
We are in Vladivostok, the region that offers the Far Eastern Hectare program.
Correct.
Anyone who has enough energy can get their land and build there. But as far as I know, not too many people have taken advantage of this opportunity.
You're right. It's not a very popular program. One of the reasons being the fact that the land in the Far East is not really good for farming. It'd be a very risky endeavor here. If this program were launched in the fertile Black Earth Belt, more people would be willing to join. This is number one. Secondly, agriculture is not for everyone. People want to live in low-rise residential buildings and at the same time have access to urban conveniences, have an urban lifestyle. There's no such option for now. Loans for individual housing construction were not introduced until recently. And I believe it's an important step towards achieving the Russian dream, but it only happened recently.
And what is the Russian dream? Is it like you said, living in the countryside and being able to enjoy the blessings of civilization?
Right. Russian people have a secluded mindset, like peasants in the old days. They prefer living in compact local communities rather than crowded places. That's why small town communities are so solid in Russia and so good-natured. My personal experience with small towns shows that they have a very pleasant social setting. Local residents are very friendly to one another and open to all types of cooperation. They appreciate good neighborliness. It's something big cities don't have.
Do you think it entirely depends on the size of the town, or perhaps on the quality of the living environment?
Size plays an essential part. The smaller the town, the more chances it will have a close-knit, solid community that will shape and develop this town. Getting back to your question about Marx and Hegel, we have a situation here when the smaller the size, the more influence residents have on their town's environment, the greater their say in defining what this environment will look like.
There's a Russian saying that you can take the girl out of the country, but you can't take the country out of the girl. It's usually meant in a negative way, but in this context, it's a good thing to be able to create this kind of countryside environment around you, a community of people who shape this environment for you and make you feel it. And in doing so, they also reflect your own identity.
The Chicago School of Sociology started to point out the inherent differences between the city and the countryside in the early 20th century. They said a big city with its specific human interactions was very different from the countryside and its social relations. The two can't be compared. But then their studies brought them to the conclusion, towards the 1930s, that people living in big cities are actually in constant search of the countryside, trying to set up a network of close connections in their urban environment that is similar to the countryside. On the other hand, modern research of the countryside, at least rural settlements located in central Russia, reported unprecedented atomization. This unmatched even by modern megapolises.
You're talking about rural areas of modern Russia.
Yes, the Kostroma region. For example, villages of the Kostroma region are not prepared to cooperate. And if they do join with efforts with other locals, it's usually half-hearted. It's an extremely atomized society. So in this sense, the juxtaposition of the city and the countryside is wrong. We'll always find a big city within the countryside and vice versa. Attempts to create a village in a big city.
I know that you've completed a study of town friendliness. Several factors were mentioned in it. One of them, simplicity of navigation. To be honest, I was surprised.
So was I.
With all the electronic services that are available today, or you can simply ask for directions too, I can't see how anyone can have problems finding their way at all. But apparently they have.
It turns out that's the purpose of studies, to uncover things that are surprising. These are the actual data we got, surprisingly. I was sure some other factor would take priority. It turns out that people find it essential to have an idea where they are going, and what they should do.
And electronic navigation instruments can't help them here. Or are they not available widely enough yet?
It appears that electronic means of navigation are some sort of a crutch that we resort to when we are desperate and have no idea where to go next.
You mean people want communication? Is that what you're saying?
People want analog communication. And digital means of communication are seen as something that we resort to when analog communication fails. Fundamentally, though, we'd like to have analog communication without using our phones.
And another very important and interesting factor that determines the perception of an urban environment is the number and quality of toilets available. This especially matters to women, I can say that for myself, children and elderly people. Where do you think toilets are the best and the worst in Russia?
Well, I don't know where the worst are. The scale of badness here.
Okay. Are there cities that set a good example in this regard?
Krasnoyarsk. When walking in Krasnoyarsk, there's almost always a rather well-appointed toilet to be found within walking distance. That's why one can take very long walks in Krasnoyarsk, dropping in bars, buying water, and drinking it right outside without having to worry about interrupting the walk. Krasnoyarsk downtown has at least 70 toilet modules installed, which is a lot.
Was it a deliberate effort on the part of local urban experts, or did it just happen that special attention has been paid to this issue in Krasnoyarsk?
Well, it's not that there was some special program.
Toilets for Krasnoyarsk.
Yes, toilets for Krasnoyarsk. Urbanists who were in charge of arranging the city's public spaces kept in mind the idea that public spaces are supposed to have toilets. And it was done. It's a basic need that didn't require a special program in Krasnoyarsk. In many other cities, that's not the case. Take Vladivostok. I spent quite a lot of time strolling around the city yesterday and didn't see even one toilet module, which reduced the time I spent walking.
I was in Nizhny Novgorod recently and asked a museum staff member for directions to a toilet. And she said, in an insulted way, "Why, this is a museum here," as if looking for a toilet was something indecent.
It's embarrassing.
An attitude often found in Russian culture. Where do you think it comes from, this bashful or contemptuous attitude towards what is essentially a basic need?
Well, this is the way our culture is. There are cultures, for example, where it's indecent to eat outside. Eating is a very intimate act for them, so they don't even think of eating in public. And there are cultures in which bodily discharge is an indecent topic. In some cultures, it's not as manifested. For example, there are street toilets in France that are nothing more than corners where people walk in to do their business relatively publicly.
Let's hope that time and the example of Krasnoyarsk help change the situation across the country. Peter, it's been incredibly interesting to talk to you. Thank you very much for your time.
Always a pleasure.
Thank you for watching. Hope to see you again on Worlds Apart.